let us hop right into issue number 21, which is the introduction of the truants. I kind of want to talk about this issue a little bit out of order, mostly because I want to talk about all the scenes in the past first, if that's okay with you guys.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here's where we officially meet the truants, which is what had been teased for a while anyway. You know, we'd always sort of suspected that there were more kids at the school. And then at the end of the last arc, we'd seen Vanessa, Ian, and Irina show up, which was just sort of that confirmation that, like, oh, okay, there's definitely a broader cast of students who sort of get what's going on. And I also thought it was interesting to find that kids that we'd seen back in issue one are returning. So, Nick, I actually saw you talk about this somewhere else. I forget what website it was, but these kids had been seeded into the book since the very beginning, right? Like, they'd basically been in the background, either in just, like, quiet discussions or, like, one-off lines of dialogue that you don't really understand until now.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really, I think, a good example of the way that we kind of seeded things in the book, especially very early on. You know, obviously when we were working on the first issue of the book, we had absolutely no idea how we would do, you know, if the book would catch on, how long the book was going to last. Even as you're working on the first arc, you know, you have a slightly better idea, but you still, you know, I remember all through the first arc, you know, you're still wondering if you're a 30-issue book or a 50-issue book or, you know, a 100-issue book or, you know, just what your trajectory is. It's a very hard thing to assess early on, and the last thing you want to do is set up a bunch of things and never have the ability to come back to them. So even if you have bigger ideas for characters, you have to be really careful for how you place them if you want to make sure that you have a rewarding payoff on things. So that was certainly the case with the first scene kids, with Vanessa and Akiko and Brendan. The bigger goal with that scene wasn't anything long term. It was more to get you into the action quickly and to give you an understanding of what kind of place this was in very short order. And to sort of, you know, I've referred to it all this way a lot of times. I wanted to do the first scene of Star Wars. You know, that you want to do that scene where you're dropped into an existing world very suddenly, and you can feel that there are a lot of stories already in play, and you know, that just makes everything a lot more three-dimensional. And so I wanted it to be that. I just wanted to hit you as hard as possible, as quickly as possible. But as you're writing it and you're coming up with these stories of who these characters are and how they got to where they are, you file that stuff in the back of your head and you say, well, you know, if the book's successful and we get a lot of time, yeah, these characters would be fun to get back to. I think it's the first 10 or 12 pages of that first issue. And I wrote that issue pretty much in order. So I was spending more time with them before I was spending any time with any of the glories. So you get a sort of immediate attachment to them. It was very much always in my head that I wanted to bring them back. I tried to keep that door open as much as possible while I was writing them then. You get a little bit of a little bit of a Captain Pike vibe there, you know, where it's not faked because they really were the first thing that you wrote. So they make kind of natural precursors. So it was great to get to come back to them. Also, Irina was a character that I had an idea for very early. And that was a little bit more of a simpler thread initially. Initially, I just had the idea, I think, of, you know, around midway of writing the first arc, that wouldn't it be really cool if before our kids got there, there had been this student who had sort of successfully rebelled and was hiding out in the woods, killing guards and you know, attacking things, and just being a general thorn in the side of the faculty. And so I thought that there was a really nice kind of Peter Pan story, and you know, there had been a sort of maybe you want to do kind of a Lost Boys vibe where, you know, there are other kids in the woods with her and stuff, and that all sort of merged into what became the Truants. You know, that's kind of a good example of how the long-term planning on this book works, that you know, you're taking these ideas and fitting them within your broader mythology in the way that makes the most sense.
And Joe, how about for you? Did you ever think, like, we'd already sort of talked about Vanessa coming back, but had you really thought about Brendan or Akiko at all since they first showed up?
I actually asked Nick, New York Comic Con 2010, I was like, hey, so people are asking me about these kids from the first part of the first issue. Were we ever going to see them again? He's like, yeah, maybe. And I'm like, okay, great. So I just kind of followed it in the back of my mind. I'm like, okay, well, you know, he'll get to it one of these days. And so I was glad to get back to him because, I don't know, it kind of, at least, you know, artistically, kind of revitalizes you to kind of draw like a new kind of cast, you know. Not that, I mean, we haven't spent a whole lot of time with the main glories. I mean, they've kind of been scattered. But it was still nice to be able to you know, basically meet some new kids or whatever, and you know, draw a different perspective. You know, they're almost kind of like the mirror versions of the glories, or the darker. I mean, you know, the main glories are pretty twisted as is, but you know, I don't know. These kids seem like a lot, you know, a bit more twisted.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that. I mean, these kids are more child soldiers, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't suppose that was something that had concerned either of you at all, was the war children thing.
Nah. I don't have any of this stuff, you know, like I have no sense of propriety. So, you know, any hesitation that I have on this stuff has to be like learned. I'll realize way after the fact, you know, that, oh man, this is actually like, this is an endorsement of child soldiers, isn't it? It just didn't even occur to me. So, yeah, it's usually afterwards that I realize, wow, that's a pretty horrific thing to do to a 12-year-old. Just doesn't occur to me initially.
So, this is kind of reflective of the fan base of the book, but okay. So we have these new characters in the book. We have Guillaume, who we'd already met, and I think everybody had kind of gotten used to him. Vanessa we'd seen before. Ian we'd seen before. Nobody really knew him. Akiko people had seen before and maybe not realized they'd seen before, and obviously, Irina had a very big introduction into the book. So, why do you think people don't trust Fortunato?
Oh, he's shifty, right? Like he's too quiet. People don't trust people who are that quiet. It's a concern. You know, I should say, just backtracking a bit. I will say that you almost saw Ian previously. Ian was somebody who I had an idea for back in the second arc. There was a time when the Hunter issue which was issue 8. He's going to play out a slightly different way, where maybe he was going to not be the only kid in trouble with those bullies with Chad and Steve. And so there was going to be a Hunter Ian scene there. And ultimately, it was a little bit of a space thing, and it was thoroughly unnecessary. Like it wasn't just, you know, it would have been fun, but it just wasn't needed at all. But it was just sort of two kids getting picked on and one kind of explaining the ropes to another, and ultimately it just didn't work. And so I never actually ended up writing it, but so Ian sort of existed in my head well before we saw him. So I was like, well, now I get to bring that kid in, because that would have been fun. But yeah, in terms of Fortunato, I think, yeah, it's he's quiet and seems very reserved, and some of the things that he's done so far have been a little on the shady side. So you know, people are a little wary of him.
So developing these kids in parallel with the other kids, I think both in design and personality, and I think it's probably interesting too, because, you know, you'd had characters like Vanessa and Akiko before, but how sort of close were you, both of you guys, in sort of mirroring them to the main cast? Because Joe, it was you that just said they're like the darker version, mm-hmm, of the main cast.
Well, I'll let Nick start on that one.
There are a lot of mirrors here. I think that the cover sells a lot of those. Maybe not precisely. You know, there might be a couple of exceptions there, but I think even when you look at the cover and the placement of the characters versus the placement of the characters on cover one, you see, you know, some of the matching points. You know, the Arena and Casey are very similar in that they're the respective leader figures of their groups, although they have very, very different ways of going about things. Hunter and Ian, it's easy to see sort of the comparison points. You know, they're both a little bit on the dorky side. They're both, you know, the socially awkward ones, and the hard luck ones. But, you know, by the same token, you know, Hunter is generally a sweet kid, whereas with you know, some caveats to that, but Ian's the same but opposite. He's a snarky, kind of slightly mean spirited kid in some ways, but again with some caveats. You know, Fortunato and Jun are an interesting comparison point in that they're both sort of strong, silent types. You know, so that's an easy kind of match point to see. Guillaume, we've certainly shown as being sort of an indifferent smartass and you know, a little mischievous and that kind of thing. And so, you know, you can draw a line there with Ike in certain respects. So, you know, you can see it kind of over and over that there are kind of commonalities in play here, and that was certainly intentional. You know, that I wanted to show what would happen to a similar group of kids if just some things went wrong. Obviously, we talk a lot about lost comparisons in this book, and the very obvious one here, I think, is with the tailies. And I think that the circumstances are very similar. And you know, there's a little bit of Ana Lucia in Arena, and just that group where a lot of the good things and a lot of the breaks that your first cast got, your next cast didn't. and you see how the story plays out so differently because of that. And that's just, you know, that's a fun thing to do in any story. You know, another good example of that is Battlestar Galactica. You see it with the Pegasus crew. You know, that's a really fun example of just how you show the same thing happening to two different groups of people, and just a few different decisions or just a few character ingredients missing. You know, just how differently things can be. I mean, one of the my favorite dynamic of the Truants versus the Glorious to me is I think there are some strong comparison points between Zoe and Arena and Vanessa and Casey, but Vanessa just doesn't have the sort of push, the sort of aggressiveness and sort of stubbornness that Casey has, and so she very much cedes ground to Arena in a way that completely upends the two group dynamics and changes the way that they do business as a result. And that's actually one of my favorite little details that I think about in terms of the group. Something that I come back to a lot is that it's just if Casey had been a little more submissive, if she had been a little more timid, and Zoe had, you know, more of an agenda, how differently things would have gone for the Glories. And I think that's what you see in the Truants.
And Joe, do you want to chime in at all for at least
the design? I think he pretty much hit the entire thing on the head there. I mean, we don't really have a Truants version of Jade per se, and I think, you know, Arena is like you said, like the way Nick kind of pitched it to me was like, you know, what if Zoe had taken charge instead of Casey or whatever? And, you know, I was like, okay, that I understand. Like, personality wise, that's what he meant. And, you know, I thought that was pretty slick. And yeah, I mean, you know, it's not like I say that kind of like mirrors, but that always makes you think of, like, you know, the Star Trek thing. Like, they should all have goatees or something. you know, I just kind of see them as sort of, you know, I mean, maybe the best way to look at it is almost like the way when Marvel did the X-Men Deadly Genesis a few years ago, and they had the other team that went to Krakoa before the new X-Men. And, you know, it's sort of like the same way that I see it, except less shoehorned in.
Yeah, I think that the one important distinction, you know, that you typically see in other stories that I didn't want to do here, just to be a little different and just to try something a little different, is usually those characters are your expendable ones suddenly. You know, that in a lot of other stories, these characters tend to die off very quickly. You know, usually to sort of make a point about, you know, why one of these groups is going to survive and what makes them special versus the other. And that's not really the plan here. You know, that I want to integrate these kids into the main cast, and you know, I want to stick with them for a good stretch of time. You know, and I think that caused us maybe in some places to pull our punches a bit. You know, I think that there's a way that we could have told this story where they could have been a lot worse. And that was something that I kept in mind, that you know, I didn't want to be going through the first arc of season two and just picking them off, you know, very, very quickly. You know, I wanted you to feel like these kids could be in the book for a long time to come.
So all of the kids have to leave this this compound here, and there's a good chunk of time in between, you know, the period when they leave and then when they grow up and head over to the school. Is that something that I'm assuming you have plans to explore in greater detail?
Yeah. I mean, we'll certainly answer the question of where they were. You know, whether or not it's a massively important story point, you know, remains to be seen. But you know, we won't be completely in the dark on where they were. You know, but I think it's reasonable to expect, given the situation, that they're tasked with infiltrating the academy, that would not be an easy process, that would not be something that was simple, and that would be something that would take an enormous amount of resources and time. You know, it's not something that you could just do in a week. So, you know, there's a long-term game that has to be played here.
And then when they're on their way to the school, I can't help but notice that there's one character that's in three out of the four panels that we have of these kids traveling.
right. Somebody's clearly keeping an eye on things, as it were. Who that person is with, or whatever, we haven't said yet.
Mm-hmm. I do like that he wears sunglasses both indoors and on an airplane.
That's the best way. Yeah. On the plane. Way to blend in, buddy.
There's also a cameo on this page for Cooter and the Aaron.
Yep, my friend Aaron Cooter, who he draws a bunch of stuff for DC now. He's a machine. The guy is crazy. So yeah, I mean, not necessarily a cameo per se, but you know, we had the whole sign thing in issue one. With, you know, Carlton Cuse and all that stuff, and you know, Nick didn't have any specific ones this time, so I just put whoever on it.
Yeah, Joe, who is the other one? The one that can't be read.
That's what I was about to ask.
Man, you know, I don't know. I'm looking at the page now and I can't even tell. So yeah, that's a good question. Maybe one of the enterprising Tumblr fans can figure it out.
I was about to say earlier that now we're definitely going to have somebody go through and draw goatees. I'd be surprised if that one doesn't show up here in the next week or so.
What was I going to say? I lost my thought here. I had a similar comment about the sign. Oh, right. The sign thing. That's not really something that you often see at the airports anymore. At least that I've been going traveling more, and I don't know if I've actually ever seen anybody hold up these signs anymore.
I have a few times. Yeah. I mean, you know, when I do conventions, if they're cool enough to like pick me up at the airport, then I'll see the sign. You know, like I mean, I'll see it in those cases. But I mean, yeah, and you know, you still see it a lot of times. I'll just kind of see the sign with like the logo. I guess maybe they know that they're supposed to look for the company, car company's logo on it or something. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I see them all the time. Heathrow and JFK both have tons of it. I think it might be, you know, like the bigger city airports tend to have them more. I think they're all over the place at those. So, yeah, no, you still see them.
So they're arriving at a big city, is what you're saying?
No. More just
tiny airport.
Yeah. You know, they do exist.
So this sequence that follows of Vanessa arriving very much mirrors still the sequence that we'd seen back in issue 1 when Casey arrives at the school, and I think. Immediately, and this happens throughout the whole issue. You know, you see them go to the orientation. There's the it's my birthday too sequence. So, you know, there's definitely a lot of parallels between this and issue one. But the one thing that I think was sort of missing, I'm going to guess that this was very much done on purpose, is you know, issue one gave everybody those. I think it was like 2 pages per character. To sort of get more used to, you know, whoever, Casey or, you know, Ike, and Ike's being drilled by his mother and Jade's writing in her journal. Was there any particular reason you guys decided not to have something similar in this issue? And I know that, you know, we're sort of skipping talking over a huge part of the book right now, but yeah.
No, I think for one thing, isn't this issue, I think this is like 36 pages or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So even you know, I mean, Joe is you know, the most prolific dude in comics at this point, but you know, even I gotta rein it in, you know, to some extent. So we couldn't do an exact beat for beat version of one, obviously. You know, you had to move through things a little quicker because rather than being the whole issue, that it's more just the flashback beats of this one. So I think that the closest that you come to that is, I think that the bus sequence is meant to sort of give you you know, an idea on a lot of these characters, that that's meant to be a scene where you get a general feel, a very quick feel for, you know, who they are and you know, what their agendas are. It doesn't give you anywhere near as much as that, those 12 pages of Morning Glories 1. But again, between that and what you have in the present day, you know, we felt like it was enough for the time being.
Mm-hmm. And we also get to see young Pamela as well.
right. Long suffering Pamela. She's due for some time.
I was going to ask how much longer until we get the Pamela centric issue.
What do we do? We seem to be getting her like one to two scenes per arc.
Right.
It seems to be about the number so far, and I'd like to make sure that we're getting her in at least a couple of times per arc, but it feels like it's been a while, so you know, she's definitely due for some catch up here. I don't know exactly when her issue's going to hit. It definitely will. You know, it's still very much you know, planned, but I don't know exactly when it's going to hit. That might be one that's very late. I'll say that. I have a feeling that one might be, you know, something that we get to when we're getting close to the end of the book.
So, Joe, I know that you put in a lot of Easter eggs throughout the book, mm-hmm. But one here, you know, even when I clarify, like, oh, is this, you know, X, Y, or Z, you never,
yeah.
Sometimes you'll tell me, like, oh, yeah, I just threw that in there. But here, we do have Guillaume reading The Count of Monte Cristo, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Now the question is, did I put that in there, or was that in the script?
Yeah, yeah. I'll go ahead and confirm that one. That was my placement.
Okay.
Yeah. I asked for that specifically.
You know, that sort of, we brought up Lost earlier, but Lost was always really good about putting in little pieces of some sort of additional, like, you know, there'd be like a record here or a book here that would sort of help illuminate certain aspects about characters. And The Count of Monte Cristo is a rather famous book about, I forget the lead character's name now. He's wrongly imprisoned and has to escape from jail and then seeks revenge on those who imprisoned him. So is that perhaps a little bit of an idea as to who Guillaume is?
I think, yeah, of course. It's definitely one of those instances where a book kind of helps illuminate a character. I don't think that again, just like when you see it in other works, it can be a little tricky in that you can prescribe a little bit too much to a character as a result of that. But there are certainly, you know, things about Guillaume's character and about the situation at large that made The Count of Monte Cristo like a fun book to throw in there.
Mm-hmm.
Put it
away. So sort of jumping ahead in their story, Irina is sort of the big focus. You know, we get time with everybody, but if we're to sort of assign a main character, you know,
sure.
She's also, you know, she's like the Casey of the group where, sure. where she's the lead. And she spends some time with Steve in this issue in a scene that very much mirrors Casey's, initial finale of issue number one. And if I remember correctly, Steve here is illustrated after, Lan Pitts. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was, I'll go ahead and cop to that. That was me misreading the script and it should have been Steve the Bully and I fucked it up and, Alex had already colored like pretty much the entire sequence. And it was one of those, well, we could go back and redraw every scene that he was in or just live with it. So we
or,
just,
or there's just two kids named Steve, which
yeah,
is not,
you know, cause I mean, God forbid there's two kids named Steve. I mean, no, right. That never happens. I mean, yeah. So, but yeah, that's another one, you know, cause Lan had been one that, supported my art and, you know, had gotten a couple of commissions from me. So I mean, it was just a, you know, what tip of the hat, kind of like putting a beard teacher in an issue, you know, just throw in a little cameo, but,
yeah. I'm still waiting for that teacher to come back. Cause they, I mean, well, I have this question here in a later issue. I might as well ask it now. This issue is not a bad, place for this question. Can they ever go back to school at this point?
Oh, that's a fantastic question because you know, if you assume that certain things are going to play out the way that you might expect in the upcoming arc, you know, eventually everybody's got to go back to class at some point, right? Or else the book has changed pretty fundamentally.
Right.
You know, at some point, these kids got to get out of the fucking woods and go back to school. You know, so if we do that, you know, then the next question is, what happens to all these kids? You know, and you're right, that is, you know, that is maybe a question for down the road, but... things have changed a lot as a result of like one day's worth of things happening for everyone. So this whole story, which will have lasted, if you count 12, which I kind of think you should, what will it be? It'll be like 17 issues or something. Like most of the book has been really this one big storyline. You know, that kind of began with PE and ran through truants, and will run through the next arc. You know, they're all basically one big story, and you know, a lot has happened.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting. Not to comment too far ahead. I think the finale does sort of lend to a place where some sort of quote-unquote normalcy can return. But it's interesting because, as we'll see in this issue and in the next issue, so much of it takes place around Woodrun that you generally get the impression that it's like, oh, well, maybe they're never going to go to class again. We're only going to see it in flashbacks.
Right.
So we have this scene that sort of, you know, mirrors Casey's. I think, if I'm correct, it's kind of like almost down to every sort of beat. It's not like a mirror of the pages from the first issue, but you know, the same sort of dialogue, the same emphasis on the reveal, even with Irina's gasp is very much Casey's. Same expression.
Right.
Is this, and obviously this is a book that has just plain reused pages and panels,
sure.
When necessary. Is this one of those sequences that it was very, very consciously aware to sort of be those pages from issue number one.
Joe, do you want to talk about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I you know, I'm sure Nick can eliminate it story-wise, but, you know, I think it's it very much, you know, you're giving, like we said earlier, like they're mirrors, sort of. So we're giving what would happen to the mirror, kind of mirror version of Casey or whatever in the same situation. You know, like what would her reaction be? And it's fun to kind of to take the readers down familiar territory because they've already read it, so they have an expectation as to the way it's going to turn out. So then we break from that, you know, we go a completely different direction after she ends up in the basement or whatever. And I thought it was pretty fun. I mean, it was I always feel weird sometimes, like, reusing stuff because I'm afraid people are going to think it's, oh, look at Joe, he's so lazy. He's just reusing pages. But, you know, it makes sense here. And, it, you know, it, there's, I mean, if we're going to try and evoke a kind of, you know, scene, or, I mean, evoke a kind of emotional response from the readers, why wouldn't we echo that scene? Why wouldn't we reuse the same shots or whatever and, you know, mirror it, as it were? And, you know, and you know, to kind of go off on a tangent there, you know, if you want to say I'm lazy with that stuff, I mean, there's still like a shit ton of new pages in there that I, you know, I draw. I mean, I still draw every single freaking line, so I don't know.
Yeah, I have a whole thing about, because it never fails, and Joe has seen me lose my mind over this. I've blown up on Twitter over this a couple of times. You know, look, first of all, reused panels and reused pages in this book are what I call for in the script. Like I say reuse this panel here and reuse this panel there. You know, that's not even something that Joe just does on his own. That's something that I ask for. And there's a very specific reason why I do it that way. I don't think that redrawing those scenes, not only do I not find it at all beneficial or helpful, I would actually find it problematic. The point of reusing those scenes, you know, in that context is to show them from a different light and to put them within another story. And if we redrew them, I think it would just end up being confusing. That it would be more difficult on the reader to then say, oh, you know, this is that same scene, but it's you know, it's not. I just think it would actually be detrimental to the book to redraw most of those scenes. You know, I don't find it really helpful. 25 was the first time that I think Joe has, like, redrawn things, and that was simply because we were doing all widescreen panels. You know, it spanned the whole 2 years of the book. And so I think I put in the script, like, it's up to you, you know, when you think it should be a reuse or when you should redraw something. You know, it really came down to the shape of the panels and things like that, I think, more than anything. Yeah, it would actually harm the book, I think, to redraw. I think it would make it more confusing and less clear. And God forbid Morning Glories be confusing. and as Joe points out, you have never gotten less than 20 plus pages of original content per issue. Like, that has just never happened. So, again, it's bonus, you know. So, you know, what in a 20-page comic would have to be like a shitty footnote, we can now show you again, and put it in its proper place within the larger story. So, yeah, it never fails. Whenever we do it, somebody somewhere will complain about it, and. You know, Joe handles it like a pro, I, on the other hand, one thing that irritates me, because, you know, this book is by far, you know, and this isn't bragging or anything, it's just a fact that, you know, in terms of books that are released by Diamond to the direct market and all that, value per page and cost per page on this book is just blows every other book out of the water. Like, there's just there's no question about it. From a content to price standpoint, you know, you are just paying way less per page for this book. So, you know, when you hear stuff like that, it always tends to irk you.
Speaking of getting irked, I like that, Joe, I like that you put a fan of the book into the book and then beat the crap out of him.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's kind of like the given nature of this book. Like, you're either going to get maimed or killed, or, you know, if you want a cameo, that's what's going to happen. That's what I always tell people. I'm like, they're like, yeah, put me in the book. I'm like, well, you know, you're probably going to die pretty horribly. Like, no, that's great. So,
yeah. I don't know. Sometimes you make it out okay.
For now.
I mean, everybody wants to be I mean, like, if you could be in The Walking Dead, you would either want to be a zombie or eaten by a zombie, right? I mean, what else is there to be to do? So that's the nature of cameos, I think.
In terms of on a more serious note, though, in terms of the action sequence here, I think it's pretty good in that it's specific in what, you know, what moves she's doing to him, how she's knocking him down. How is this sequence sort of choreographed?
Well, there's one on there, and I copped to it, I think, on Tumblr or Twitter, one of those. It's like page 32, the second panel of her kicking his ass. I mean, that's like the most blatant manga panel I've ever drawn, I think. you know, and yeah, so it you know, I got 20th Century Boys right next to my desk, so I look at his fight scenes and how he tilts the camera and, you know, how he has people punching and jabbing each other and stuff. So that's kind of where I get my inspiration. I just go to YouTube, man, and I just, like, you know, fighting. I look up different kinds of, like, fist fighting and stuff like that, because fist fights are you know, punches or, you know, that's the thing that I think is one of the hardest things to draw in, like, an action sequence, because, you know, otherwise it just kind of looks like two people faking a punch or whatever. So YouTube is, you know, it's a good resource.
So this isn't something, Nick, that you even had any, like, sort of direction on? It was just kind of like, oh, she beats him for four panels?
Yeah, no, I tend to leave, you know, fight sequences and stuff to Joe. You know, it's you know, a good opportunity to get out of his hair. And I think I had the one thing that we said was, you know, that he couldn't have any marks.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You know, that he couldn't walk out of there, you know, with a black eye or with a bloody nose, because obviously she's told him what to go and tell the faculty and so yeah, it's so you know, they all needed to be hits that wouldn't necessarily leave a mark, but yeah, other than that, this page is entirely Joe.
Is there any particular reason that you didn't want to leave a mark?
Oh yeah, no, like I said, it was down to she wanted him to go to the faculty and tell them that she had broken down crying.
Okay.
And so if he were nursing, you know, a black eye and a bloody nose when he went to the faculty and reported back, you know, it would have kind of blown the story that she wanted to tell at that point.
Right. So. Okay. So I think Joe, I think this was your sort of explanation for her at one point, but focusing in on Irina, she's kind of like the new Zoe, even beyond the, like, well, you know, what if Zoe had led the book instead of Casey? Right. Like, she kind of sort of takes Zoe's place in the book after killing her.
Yeah, essentially. I mean, when last year at Emerald City Con, and Nick told me, you know, he's going to kill Zoe, and I was like, dude, Zoe's like my hottest seller. He's like, don't worry, I got this. I got the thing care of. Somebody that'll be, you know, just as good. So yeah, she kind of does fill that Zoe void, you know.
And she keeps, she'll do this more. Why she keeps shooting at Hunter?
I don't think that she has, you know, like I, this is actually, I have a question for Jared. Like, has she been a good commission seller?
To Arena? Yeah. I've had a couple.
Not quite Zoe.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, she hasn't, you know, been out, I don't think, quite as, she hasn't been in as many issues as Zoe had, I think.
Sure.
So, but no, she's, I do get requests for her, but the Zoes and the Caseys were probably the number one requests.
At least we have some other girls in the cast, though. I used to always feel terrible about just the general lack of Jade commissions.
Well, you know, looking and everything and kind of sad. So, I mean, yeah, I think that's probably, nobody wants a sad girl hanging up in their office or whatever. So maybe they want older Jade now, since, you know, kind of making her kind of a, you know, a gilf or whatever.
How many Dagny commissions do you get?
Zero.
We're going to have to change that.
I should also point out, though, that one of my big goals with the truants was we needed hotter guys.
Yeah.
I was like, we need, you know, like I think that Zoe commented very early on in the second issue, you know, that the guy selection was somewhat underwhelming in her eyes, and when we were coming up with the truants, I said, you know, we got to have a couple of guys who are, you know, easy on the eyes. You know, and so Fortunato and Guillaume were both very much designed with that in mind. I sent over pictures of absolutely beautiful men for Joe and Ricky. Been like, these are our refs.
I didn't even ask like what he, how he Googled that and how he came across that. But, yeah,
I should say who they are. But you know, maybe Joe, maybe if you have it somewhere handy, I can't remember who the Fortunato reference was. He's a model.
Yeah, he is a model. I don't have it.
I can't remember his name. Guillaume, though, is the French kid from the Inbetweeners. For all the Inbetweeners fans out there, he is, his real name is Vladimir. I'm missing his last name, but. But he's meant to be the he was the ref point for Guillaume, which is fun for anybody that's watched the Inbetweeners.
Oh, the French, okay.
Just you know, every woman on the show suddenly flocks to him and falls in love with him.
Yeah, Patrice,
right?
Yeah,
right. And, you know, Patrice has those awesome eyebrows.
Yeah, I'm like, I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, yeah, so that's the ref for Guillaume.
That's
so
funny.
So, yeah, I was like, one of our missions here has to be a couple of stunning dudes.
we talked about this on other episodes in the past, but, you know, you do draw a lot of attractive females in the comic, so how different was it to sort of like switch gears and be like, all right, let's draw some hot dudes for a while?
It was actually refreshing, because, you know, surprisingly enough, I'll say, because, you know, a lot of our readership is female, which surprised me, because I thought guys would see this, oh, schoolgirls, I'm totally into this. But we actually get a pretty big female fan base, and, you know, I was like, all right, I'm kind of glad to give them something to look at, you know.
I'll say a couple of things on that front. Like, I think if you just went by the internet, I know that this is probably not true, you know, in terms of the broader numbers. If you went just by the internet presence, you would think that this book's audience was about three quarters female. I tend to find, you know, just based on like Twitter and Tumblr responses, that, you know, the book is the book has a huge female audience, which is like a major point of pride for me on the book. That you know, I think it's really, really nice when you know, you feel like you're writing a book that's appealing to an audience that's a little broader. And that's been a major point of pride for me. But you know, I tell you, I was stunned by just, you know, and I know that we talked about this on the last set, but I had no idea that the Guillaume Jun romance would capture people's imaginations to the point that it has, often in very direct language. I had no idea that would get the engines running to the extent that it did, and that's awesome. that's been a lot of fun.
I mean, yeah, I think that makes sense to me. You know, sort of just with the way comic fans tend to be in the way of their expression of their love for comics, in whether it be certain illustrations or complete fan fiction or.
Oh, when we got Joe, actually, our first slash fic, I think Joe found it. Yeah. And we were giddy. We were just, we you know, like we'd arrived. We were very happy about that.
It was something else.
A very twisted part of me kind of wants to read that.
It was well done. I thought it was very well done.
Is that something that you're going to try and incorporate into the book now?
We look, you know, like everybody wants back matter.
Right. So you're going to post that in the back of the book.
Why not?
Perfect. So getting back to the stuff that takes place in the now, the present day for the group, one thing that I think is particularly noticeable, and this is definitely a serious question as opposed to all the ridiculous questions we've done. One thing that's noticeable is that even though the truants are a group, they seem to be very separated. Like, the glory is always kind of stuck together with the exception of Ike, you know, because obviously he betrayed everybody. But, you know, the truants, they're sort of splitting off into factions, in the sense that Irina is not telling everybody everything. You know, we'd sort of talked about mirrors and whatnot in the book, but this feels more of a conscious, like, concerted effort to sort of split them apart than just to say, like, oh, well, you know, this is the other version of, you know, X, Y, or Z.
It is and it isn't. You know, I find one of the most interesting things about the way that people read the book is, you know, in particular Casey, because she's placed in that kind of good guy leader role, people will look past things that they might not with other characters. You know, so you'll notice when Irina is being very manipulative and giving one person the full story and holding back the other story. But Casey, for example, did not let Zoe know about the full plan to rescue Jade. You know, she basically asked Zoe to put her life on the line without ever telling her what, you know, she was really going to be doing, because she decided that she couldn't trust her. Oh, wow. Excuse me. My dog has decided to pick a fight with the mirror. He does it all the time. So as a first example, yeah, Casey doesn't tell Zoe about her full plan there. When Casey is in the cave with Jade and Ike, She has not told Jade anything about Lara and the stuff that she said about her parents. She's clearly very manipulative with Hunter and, you know, very directly kind of plays on Hunter's attraction towards her to get him to go along where he might not be willing to. So Casey has done, you know, any number of things that maybe the ends were justifiable and noble. You know, Casey is no stranger to sort of keeping people in the dark about things or, manipulating people and putting them in the position where she needs them to be. So it's a fun example of kind of how we judge the same actions differently based on the kind of hat that the person is wearing. You know, that one of these characters wears a white hat and the other one wears a black hat, and we, you know, it impacts our view of what are essentially the same movements. So it's just, you know, it's a good example of kind of the same kind of person in certain ways, but differences in other ways, you know, can really change things.
You know, that's actually a good call. I think I've been very open that I have a strong distrust of Casey. even though, like, she's sort of the de facto lead in many ways. But I have often found that I refuse to fully trust her. And somehow her actions in the first arc, in comparison to this, hadn't occurred to me.
Yeah, sure. It's again, you know, that kind of character gets a pass on a lot of things. Even if you are trying to kind of keep an eye on them, you know, just that it's one of the things that this book is so much about is the fun that you can have with archetypes. You know, that high school stories in general are exercises in tropes and they're exercises in archetypes. You know, they all kind of have these sort of ritualistic roles of, you know, the jock and the princess and the nerd and, you know, that we paint very broad strokes most of the time in terms of fiction set in this age range. Despite the fact that most of us can remember that life was nowhere near that simple at that age, but we still, for whatever reason, you know, that's what we do when we tell stories about it. And so there's an enormous amount of fun that you can have with upending those things and twisting those things or casting doubt on those things. And, you know, that's what the best fiction about this age range does is it takes those things and then makes you see them differently or, you know, makes you question them.
So the last thing that I kind of want to touch on with this issue, in an issue where I'm just sort of noticing it now, how very few moments there were where I tried to challenge you with like super direct questions. It seems, you know, just sort of at a glance, when just looking at the truants, you know, looking at the cover of issue 21 and looking at the cover of issue 1, that, you know, perhaps one of the goals, even though some of these characters had appeared before, was just to introduce a greater aspect of diversity to the book.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, our initial cast was reasonably diverse, you know.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that's always been, you know, something that I wanted to be a part of the book. You know, there were reasons. You know, we thought initially a little bit about, you know, could the book handle a bigger cast, you know, and been a little bit more diverse from the get-go. And ultimately, I just felt like going past 6 was really pressing it in terms of being able to devote the time
to them that we would have needed and really established their identities. I mean, I think we've all read books where, you know, they have a huge cast and you just don't really get to know anybody as a result. And I wanted to make sure that that didn't happen. There are other challenges with this kind of diversity in terms of having kids from a lot of different countries, because most of them are not going to be English speakers as their first language. And so you have to really consider that, and you know how much of that you can handle. Fluency is very different from it being your first language. You need the book to be an entertaining read, and you need the dialogue to be strong from the get-go. And so if you drop too many, you know, non-native English speakers into the mix at once, it can be really tough in terms of establishing the kind of tone that we wanted to establish for the book early on. So yeah, there was definitely it was a good opportunity to bring in a few more countries and to add some more diversity into the mix. I think that there will always be a few more Americans than is realistic to the story, and that's like anything, you know. It's just a matter of where most of your audience is, and being realistic about that. But you know, I'm really proud of the book. I think we have one of the most diverse casts in comics, and we're not quite done in that regard, but you know, I think that's definitely something that I'm really happy about with the book, is that it's pretty wide representation.
Okay, well, is there anything about issue number 21 that we missed that we didn't cover?
No, I think we got it.
Joe, how about for you? Else?
I think we got it. I mean, you know, we talked about revisiting her, but I guess I want to say, since this is really the first real appearance of Ian, that this kid, oh my god, he cracks me up. Like, he's one of my favorites to draw, just because, I don't know, like I told Nick on the last chat, you know, whenever he told me about him initially, he's like, I just got him initially. I just got it. I know who this kid is. And it's always fun to draw him, and I love to draw his little sneer that he does. That's my favorite thing to do. So, you know, I like the fact that he is, you know, I guess, you know, he's their Hunter, but, you know, he's really the most asshole version of Hunter that could ever be. So, but yeah, and I don't know. I hope we have, I don't know. I hope there's a lot of, you know, I know Nick will probably find a way to make the kid's life a living hell, and I can't wait to draw that. So.